across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is edition 50 of The Unexplained. Thank you for keeping faith with my show over these years. And thank you also for waiting for this special edition 50. Now, we've had a bit of a change of plan. I know it's not the first time we've had that, but that is the nature of webcasting and broadcasting and life, I guess. I've got lined up for edition 50 a very special guest, somebody who is world-renowned, very well-known, and I know you would enjoy him. There's been a delay with that, so he will not be the guest now for a few weeks. So, while we wait, I thought it would be nice to do this. Over the years, I've had many requests to go back into the archives of The Unexplained to bring you some of the material that has not been here online before. So that's what we're going to do. I've cherry-picked a few of the best guests that we had, and we're going to start with the very first guest on the first show. This was a hookup to KABC Los Angeles and a man called Dr. Bruce Goldberg, whose special subject is future life progression. Now, you may have heard of people who do hypnotherapy and hypnotism, and they regress you to supposed past lives. This man, he says, takes you forward as far as the year 3000 and beyond in some cases. Dr. Bruce Goldberg, we'll hear from him in just a moment. But before we do, and before we start this special archive edition of the show, just to thank you for your New Year wishes and for the many emails that have come in, loads and loads and loads of guest suggestions, many from North America. Wherever in the world you are, please spread the word about this show. Please keep the donations coming. They are vital, as I always say, to this work, and they will help sustain us through the year 2011. So please keep those coming, keep the feedback coming, and also give me your thoughts about, number one, the show, and number two, the new website. Adam Cornwell's worked very hard in developing a new version of our website. We have big plans for this show, and they will unfold for you here during 2011. I am excited, and I hope you share my excitement in all of this. So the special guest who should have been here hopefully is on his way. I will keep checking on him, and as soon as he's available, we'll get him on. Future special guests include Gerald Celente, by the way, the trend watcher who will tell us about the world economy and what we can expect during this year. He was on a year ago, thought it was good to get him back. You liked him then. But for right now, let's start this special archive edition of The Unexplained with the very first guest from the very first interview, Dr. Bruce Goldberg. In Los Angeles, California, at the studios of KABC, the man who says that he can do future life progression.
It's a pleasure to be with your new Unexplained show to kick it off, as they say, across the pond.
Well, listen, I'm very, very pleased that you could do it. And what do you think about the build-up? Was I right with everything I said there?
You are correct. And I just want to make a couple of introductory remarks to show you how this works. First, in America, which basically is, I think, a pretty conservative country, most recent Gallup poll shows that 58% of Americans believe in reincarnation. So this is not unusual for our country. And England, of course, is, I think your figures are even higher. To show you the example of going into the future and how it's relevant and how it's, you might say, verifiable. In my newest book, Past Lives, Future Lives Revealed, of course, I go into lots of cases of both past and future lives. But here's a case, quickly, of a young college student. I call her Tammy. In June of 1996, she came to my office to learn how to go into the future and to learn how to leave her body, which is one of the things I work with in my Los Angeles office. And I said, fine. She goes into the future by using the techniques and sees little events while she's in Los Angeles that occur a day or so in advance. So she establishes a good track record. She goes home, and this is about 2 weeks later, and calls me up and says, Doctor, I'm going to go to Europe the last half of the summer, and I wanted to see how my trip would go, so I did your techniques, and I saw myself leaving JFK, she's from New York City, mm-hmm. The plane goes up in the air, immediately crashes, and she dies in the crash, in her vision. And she goes, Doctor, what do I do? And I said, Tammy, your track record is excellent, and I don't want to run your life, I do believe in empowering people, but why don't you change your flight, and call me at the end of the summer? So she does, and around the end of August or so of 1996, she calls me up and she goes, Doctor, I had a great trip in Europe, and I want you to know that you saved my life, which of course I didn't do, and I said, Tammy, what's going on? She was going to go on TWA Flight 800.
Right.
July 17th, 1996, 230 people died. She would have been 231. So now we have an established credibility documentation, if you will, of how these future, this is an age progression, how accurate they are.
Well, Bruce, do we have an example of that, or do we just have an example of coincidence? Because coincidences happen to all of us each and every day. Tell me why that's not so.
Okay, well, let me give you an example. I put this as a summary in my my newest book. Here's an example of a novelist that I guarantee you, you and your audience do not know of. His name is Morgan Robertson, and you tell me if this is a coincidence. In 1898, he wrote a novel called Futility, in which a supposedly unsinkable ocean liner struck an iceberg on its maiden voyage, carrying the elite society of two continents to their deaths. This ocean liner was 800 feet long, weighed 70,000 tons, but had too few lifeboats. And the name of the ocean liner in this novel was called the Titan.
I see what you're saying. Well, that's very close to Titanic, but that's a premonition, isn't it? That's not a future life.
Well, it's actually, that's an age progression in this life. Obviously, if you want to document a future life progression, you've got to be really patient, because we're talking about hundreds of years, in certain cases, even thousands of years.
The one thing that worries me, and, you know, obviously as a journalist, and I think any, as we say here in Britain, the punter will ask this question, by doing what you do, and by putting people under the hypnotic influence, and we've all seen performers in this country and in your country do that, and, you know, there is a lot of documented evidence that this can be achieved. Are you not afraid that you are messing with people's minds and actually planting seeds or doing damage there that could give them problems down the track?
Well, I've done actually over now 14,000 patients and done 35,000 procedures on these people over the last 30 years, and if this was a problem, I would be Charlie Manson's roommate by now.
Direct from the studios of KABC in Los Angeles, Dr. Bruce Goldberg talking about future life progression. How would you like to travel up to the year 3000 and see what it's like then? I'm not sure if I would, you know. I'd quite like to see the 1950s, but I'm not sure whether I want to go as far as the year 3000. Who knows what will have happened to the world by then? Somebody who became a friend of the show is Colin Fry, the famous medium in the UK, a man who packs out theatres, a man who's never off the television. This is one of his early appearances.
There are three ways in which spirit can communicate with us. And that's one, obviously through a medium. Secondly, shortly after they've passed over, many people have the experience of a direct communication, but this seems to be shortly after someone's passed over. And then the other way is through dreams. And if you think about it, and this is something that I think that maybe, you know, science should put some research into, is the fact is that, you know, people do often talk about having these communication dreams, is that, you know, maybe in the dream state, the vibrations or the waves of the brain change to the extent that people that are normally not mediumistic become mediumistic in the sleep state. Maybe there is something that, I mean, I know from the little bit of research that I've been involved in, and when I've been involved in testing, you know, it has been said that, you know, when I'm in the process of receiving communication or working with mediumship, something seems to be happening within the brain. So, you know, I would say to you, this is not an unusual experience, and there are lots of people that report to me that they have the experience of communication in the dream state.
A lot of people, Colin, experienced, in fact, I was one of those people, dreams around the time of 9/11. I had a dream about a silver plane, and it had United Airlines on the back sliding out of the sky into a field somewhere that was about 3 days, maybe four, before 9/11.
I mean, I'm going back quite a few years ago now, but I was having very profound dreams about boats sinking just before the Zeebrugge disaster, and I got a sense of, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew that something was going to happen involving a boat sinking.
All right, more calls. Debbie in Manchester.
Hi,
hello,
Colin.
Debbie.
I'd like to ask that I don't believe the spirit world is all pure and good. Has anything bad or evil ever come to you, and could a spirit possess you?
What I would actually say to Debbie is that the spirit world is pure and good, just like this world is pure and good. It's the people that occupy it that are, whether they're pure and good. You know, however you might believe in God, you know, or the creator, I cannot accept that God is capable of creating anything that is intrinsically evil. But what I would say is that because we have free will, and we are capable of acting to and against one another, that we create our own negativity by what we do to one another. Now, if all I was interested in as a medium was the good and the nice and the pure people and conveying nice messages, you know, people that are good and people that are in the light don't need to know about it. What I would have to say to you is, a medium, I feel that it is as much my responsibility as a medium to help those people that are passed over, that are hurt, damaged, confused, frightened, angry. I have as much responsibility as a medium towards them as I do the good people.
And what about what they call demonic possession? What's that?
Well, you know, I think my personal feeling is that I think that the demon or the devil is something of our own creation. It's the personification of the worst that's in everybody.
Is it true also, Colin, that sometimes people who've passed, if we assume there is something over there, don't always use a medium, don't always use obvious ways to do it?
I was very recently given a book to read by a lady medium that I was working with for a while, called Signals. And it's probably one of the, it took me an afternoon to read it. It was one of the most heartwarming books that I'd read for a long time. It was about a guy whose partner died of AIDS. Committed suicide because he had AIDS, and he was going to join him. He was going to do exactly the same thing, and they had a thing between them about hummingbirds, and he suddenly started seeing hummingbirds in places and at times of the year when he just shouldn't see them.
Now the skeptic would say it's just like you buy a brand new car and you haven't seen those cars around normally, and you buy this new car and suddenly they're everywhere.
The sceptics will say many things, and what I would have said to the individual is, if it means something to you, if you feel, not think, but if you feel, this is my loved one saying something to me.
The medium Colin Fry. This is a special archive edition of The Unexplained, bringing you some of the guests that you've wanted to hear from this show's archives. Now here's somebody I found simply by doing research and using my contacts. Paul Hellyer is a former Defence Minister of Canada. Now, he made a lot of headlines for himself about 5 years ago by going public and saying that he believed there was more to UFOs than perhaps we've been told.
The day I made my speech in September, President Bush announced that the Americans were going back to the moon. Well, as soon as I heard that, I said, they're going to establish a defense base on the moon. This is something that has been in the works for a long while. Colonel Corso has a whole chapter on it in his book called The Moon Base. And his boss, General Arthur Trudeau, drew up the precise plans for what they had to have on the moon to establish a base there. And they apparently tried to get succeeding generations of politicians to go ahead with it, to authorize it, but without success, and rightly so in my opinion. But now it appears that President Bush has succumbed and that they're going to move in that direction to get what a military person would call the high ground. But I think it's not just the high ground, it's a very dangerous idea.
But Paul Hellyer, beyond the book that you read that was obviously very compelling for you, and you saw a television program that also was compelling for you, and the words of an unnamed American military man, what proof do we have of any of this? Why do we know this is so?
There are all kinds of documents, and there are many people of good repute who have gone public on that.
And they've clearly swayed you, and a man in your position, you have a status in Canada. It must have been a massive leap of faith for you to actually go out there and do this, because people who do what you're doing tend to put themselves outside the establishment, and they open themselves up for a lot of criticism, don't they?
That is true, and it's only because I thought it was so important that I did it. But, for example, President Clinton's former White House Chief of Staff, John Podesta, has done the same thing. And he has tried to persuade members of Congress to start an inquiry into the matter, so far without success. And that's one of the reasons that we're trying to get the Defense Committee here in our Senate to start, in the hope that that would have some influence on the Americans.
And are you confident that although America might be able to, or the government behind the government might be able to take steps to stop anything like that happening south of your border, that within Canada the freedom is there to be able to go ahead and do this and investigate it and say the things that you believe need to be said?
Yes, I think we have more freedom here. I'm not sure that it would have any ultimate influence, but it might. It would certainly be a temptation to the mainline press to pay more attention. There is an American by the name of Dr. Stephen Greer who claims to have over 400 government intelligence, military, and corporate whistleblowers who are ready to testify.
If we believe a lot of the fiction that we've read and a certain amount of the fact that we know, people who say some of the things that you've said, especially if they are fairly prominent, put themselves at a certain amount of risk. Do you have any fear in saying these things, Paul?
Oh, I guess not a lot. But I know there's some risk involved. But at my age, it's probably not as important for me as it would be for somebody who was younger.
The former Defence Minister of Canada, Paul Hellyer. And I guess it takes a lot of guts to actually go public and say, in the position that this man has been in, and still very prominent, that he believes that there is perhaps more to UFOs than we've been led to believe over the years. That was an interview that came to me thanks to my friends at CFRB Radio in Toronto. They had a contact number for him. I called him, and he just happened to agree to doing the show. Sometimes it all happens as easily as that. Sometimes there's an awful lot more research to do, and sometimes, despite your best efforts, the shows don't happen the way you expect them to happen. But then, you can be surprised, and sometimes they can be much better than you ever anticipated. On now is somebody I knew nothing about at the time, Charles Hall. I'd forgotten about this interview until I found it on a tape. Charles Hall is a man who says that he's had personal contact with aliens. I got Charles Hall on together with my friend UFO watcher, space researcher Paola Harris. So Paola was in Italy, and Charles Hall, alien contactee, was in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Here's what happened.
In the mid-1960s, I was a weather observer in the U.S. Air Force, and I was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada, outside Las Vegas, Nevada, for over two years. And during that time, I spent most of the time as the weather observer out in the Nellis Gunnery Ranges in Indian Springs Valley. And Indian Springs is just across the mountains from Area 51. And at the north end of Indian Springs Valley, there's a base that the American U.S. Air Force maintains for aliens, for tall white aliens. And it's physically...
For what aliens?
For aliens that I call tall white aliens. They look like humans, but they have... They look very similar to humans, but they have chalk-white skin. And the base is physically out in Area 54, and their living quarters are out in Area 53. And that's why that Area 53 and Area 54 is called Dreamland.
So we've heard of, a lot of us have heard of Area 51, where all sorts of stuff is supposed to go on. But you're saying there's an Area 53 and an Area 54 where aliens who look a bit like us have been living, and the government of the United States and the American military know about it.
That's correct. Now, to the best of my knowledge, there aren't any aliens at Area 51 itself, but Area 53 and Area 54 are inside the Area 51 perimeter.
So there you are. You're a weather observer for the U.S. military. You're doing your job of checking the meteorological conditions. You're noting your readings down. You're doing your job just as you should have. Then what happens?
The aliens, you know, that lived on the base, it was up in the mountains. Well, it's out in the desert. They'd get bored. They'd come down to where I was, you know. They have men, women, and children, and they'd bring the children about half the time they came down just so that the kids could play, you know.
Describe that first contact. Here you have a bunch of bored aliens. There they are, stuck up at Area 53, 54, and they decide they want to take a stroll, perhaps take the night air. They walk down. They see you, weather observer. What do they do? What did they do? Did they say hi? Guess they did.
When I went up there, my friend, the other airmen who were stationed at Indian Springs, and there were 10 or 12 of them, they told me that there was a base up there with aliens on there, and I didn't believe them. And I, at night, I stayed at the Indian Springs base alone in there was a barracks, and I stayed alone in the barracks. And the first contact was the aliens would come through my barracks at night, just, you know, to play and because they were curious. And so when I would wake up at night, I would think that I was dreaming or that I was nuts or something. You know, I'd get up in the morning, I'd say, boy, did I have an unusual dream last night.
Well, that would be your first thought, wouldn't you? I guess you'd check that you were awake. You'd have a look around your bed for beer cans just in case it was one of those nights. If neither of those things were true, you know, you'd say, what happened to me? What was that about?
Well, you know, so at first I thought that it was just me, and then when I would go out to take the morning weather report, I'd get up at 3 in the morning, and then I'd have to drive out to the ranges. The first weather report was due at, it began at 4:30, and of course the aliens, you might see them up the valley, their suits were fluorescent, and you might see them from a distance as fluorescent as... you know, fuzzy patches of fluorescent lights. If they got up close, then you could see them as actual
but
people.
This first contact, though, what was it like and what did they say to you? They were curious? They were bored with being stuck away in their Area 53?
When I finally realized that I wasn't dreaming, the first contact is very terrifying for me.
I bet.
It took me more than 6 months to get over the terror of... of interacting with aliens or coming across them.
But Charles, I have to say that I think a lot of us would probably never get over that. If that happened to me, I'm not sure, that I'd be here now.
Yeah, and it wasn't until 6 months had gone by that I just got up one day and I, as described in book two of my Millennial Hospitality series, that I just decided that there was nothing the matter with me, that whatever I was looking at was real. And but there was a time in there for several weeks where, if they came, even though they didn't come to harm me, where the result on my part was terror or panic or, gee, I'd have to run away or, there were I had a lot of terrifying nights. Meeting the aliens was an extremely emotional experience. I estimate that in the course of those 2 years, I probably felt every emotion that, I as a human could feel.
Charles, how did they communicate with you? The tales that we tend to read and hear and see in the movies is that these people do not speak. They think at you. Is that how they communicated with you?
No, they're not telepathic. If they show up without their technology, and they haven't taught themselves to speak English, then you're down to hand signals. But some of them have learned to speak English, and they can learn to speak English. So those who had learned to speak English could come up and say "Good evening, Charlie," if they chose to. Although they didn't usually choose to start a conversation with a greeting, they didn't usually say hello when they came or goodbye when they left. They usually just came and started talking. But their electronics were more advanced than ours, and they had electronic communication equipment which they wore in their helmets if they were wearing them. And the electronic communication equipment allowed them to put thoughts directly in your consciousness if you were relaxed.
Okay, we're down to the good stuff now then. So what did they tell you? What did they want to say to you, Charles Hall, doing your job?
One night, the alien lady whose CIA name was the teacher came with three kids and asked in English, is it okay if the children play on the steps of the control tower while I take my weather report? And I said yes. And another night, I was out there taking my weather report, and it was in the morning run, and I turned around, and there was the teacher and one of her cousins, a lady. Of course, they never came alone. They always came in groups, and they always had guards, and they were always well-armed. And one of the ladies, the younger lady, happened to be standing between me and the weather shack, and I'd gotten to where I wasn't panicky or where I didn't scream and run like I had, and so I thought about it, and I said, I need to finish this, and I said to them, I need to finish this work before I can drive in for breakfast. You never want to get between a man and his work. In kind of a lighthearted fashion.
Did they get the joke? Did they understand what you were trying to say?
Yeah, and the lady smiled and stepped to one side and let me walk to the weather shack without being in my way. And at the time, it was in kind of a lighthearted fashion because I was really nervous, even though I'd gotten over where I was panicky. But, sometimes when you're ill at ease, you are in a tough situation.
Did they tell you what they were there to do? What they were on that base to do?
No, but it became apparent. Everything I knew I had to learn by thinking it through and watching and, seeing for myself. They use the base the same way that the American Air Force uses bases in other countries, perhaps Spain or Italy, as a place for their deep spacecraft to come in and refuel and refurbish and then stand out to space again. So they use it the same way we use an airport or any other air base. And, if the spacecraft needed repairs, they needed a place to get in and do the repairs. And so the aliens that were up there were the guys who ran their base for their people, you see.
Charles, let's just hold it there. Paola Harris is still in Rome, Italy, listening to all of this. And, she's investigated you and listened to your story. Paola, when you first heard that story that Charles is telling us now for the first time here in the UK on the air, what did it make you think? What was your first thought when you heard this guy, who sounds so matter-of-fact about it all, tell you a story like that?
I thought it was extremely interesting because he talked about women and children, and he obviously was a weather observer that worked on the base, and he had written three books, and it wasn't until I read the books that I even contacted him, because the books are in detail. He talks day by day about his contact with these people, and after I had read the books, then I went right down to New Mexico to talk to him and interview him. But you have to really read the books in detail to know what he lived through during those years.
Well, it sounds amazing. Charles, the one question that I would ask is the first thing that I would think is, you know, what stopped you from, if it was being published then, I think it probably was, what stopped you from running to the National Enquirer and telling them your story immediately at that point?
Well, first I want to say hello, Paula, because Paula and I are good friends.
Hi, Charles. This is totally amazing from Rome.
Yes, we're one big global link up here, you know.
I know,
that's what
it's
we
amazing.
Do. But, you know, what stopped you from going public immediately? Did you fear that somebody might shoot you, or what?
Well, in the 60s, when I was a weather observer, there were at least 41 weather observers before me who had, in the 7 years before me, who had gone up there and had been compromised, had been intimidated, scared, frightened, some had been burned.
So you thought, if I step out of line here, the same thing's going to happen to me. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not like I was the first weather observer to go up there and see him. I was the one who survived. I was the one who went out there, became terrified, came back, overcame my fears, went back out there, until there came a day when I was the only one they wanted or would allow to go out there.
So you became their friend?
Yeah, or their co-worker, or, you know, on working terms, sociable working terms with them. The same way you would if you were, you know, when you're in the Air Force and you're in a foreign country and you're working with other people. And some of us became, you know, close, well, I would say friends, but there was, from my point of view, there was never a time when it wasn't public. I mean, you say, well, gee, why wouldn't I, you know, why would I go to the, there's no point in me going to the Air Force and saying, by the way, there's aliens out on the base, because
the
Air Force is running the base.
No, what I'm talking about is you going to a newspaper, selling your story.
Well, the other guys were out there, and see, there's a tremendous amount of denial that a human feels when you first come across aliens. And some of the guys who knew they were real were still in denial, and you see in my book, I was in denial for at least 6 months, and, you know, denying that was real. And then later, when I'd tell people, like when I got back from Vietnam and stuff, well, nobody really would listen, you know, and I found that merely by talking that I couldn't really convey how it felt.
But I guess in a way for you, talking about it has been a bit of a therapy for what has to be, even though you seem to have handled it well, quite a traumatic experience. Listen, if you want to ask a question of Charles Hall, you've heard his story now. We're going to hear some more of it. By all means, in the quarter of an hour or so, we've got to the top of the hour here. Come on. Charles Hall from New Mexico, United States of America, is online to us now, telling us his story. There he was, just innocently doing his job for the American military, as they say, doing weather reports, and he's encountered by... And he encounters aliens who communicate with him, and they seem to be pretty reasonable people by the sounds of it. Charles, over the years, you've told people the story, and you know that a lot of people are going to say, you're a nut. How do you come back at them if they say that? Because, you know, American people, they tell it like it is, a lot of them.
Everyone is free to, you know, to think what they want. My point in telling the story is that encountering the aliens was extremely emotional, and what I wanted to do was to convey that emotion, to explain to people what that emotion was, specifically to my kids and my grandkids. And so when I first started writing the books, I was specifically trying to write a biography or an autobiography that I could pass on to my kids, because, and say, how I felt going out there at 4 in the morning and encountering aliens from another planet. And how that whole experience was.
Well, you know, it's not the kind of thing that happens every day, is it?
Yeah, and I found that I couldn't convey that merely with the spoken word. I really had to write it down in order to convey those emotions.
Well, listen, we've got some calls coming of you. We're going to get to those very, very soon. A traumatic experience must be, but one that you seem to have handled. And maybe you've handled it by writing books and talking about it. Is that right?
That's true. And also, there did, as you see in my books, there did come a, after I after 6 months or so when I got used to being around the aliens, there did come a time where, you know, where I could just go out there and do my duties without, in kind of an ordinary manner. But remember, even at the end, every time the aliens came, there was always a certain emotion, you know, associated with that, because they're really not human, a certain tension.
All right, I'm going to get some calls on now to ask the questions that I haven't thought of. Cheryl, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Cheryl. What do you want to ask Charles Hall? He's listening to you in New Mexico tonight.
A few years ago, in the mid-70s, I shared a flat with a female. Well, there were a few of us all sharing, but this particular girl, I said to her after a week of strange dreams, I'm having dreams. And when I told her the dreams, she had the same dreams. So we wondered what was happening. I said, are you dreaming you're on a UFO spaceship? And she said, yes. So we compared notes and we both dreamt the same dream night after night, and the inside of the craft was green. So why I'm asking you now is, has anyone ever said that the inside of a craft looked as though it was bathed in a green light?
Good question, Cheryl. Do you believe that you were abducted?
Well, I don't know, because we shared the same room, different beds, but the same room.
Had the same dream.
And obviously we're both asleep at the same time, so we don't see the other one disappearing. But the dreams were spot on the same, and I could take you around the deck of the ship and show you the controls. And
well, Charles Hall is a man I think you really ought to ask that question. Charles, what do you think of that? Is that something that you've heard before?
I haven't heard anything quite like that before, but I note that the tall whites, when they're writing, they preferred to write on pink. Their lettering, their natural way of writing, was not black on white, but was pink on white. And that's because their eyes were sensitive to more wavelengths of light than ours. And so in the case of the green light on board, you know, the spacecraft that the lady is describing, you know, you might ask, well, is it perhaps because the aliens on board, perhaps their eyes are more sensitive to different wavelengths of light than
could be.
Are.
Well, Cheryl, how do you feel about the experience then, all these years later? Presumably you think about it, you wouldn't have been calling tonight.
No, I've lost contact with the people I shared the flat with. Uh-huh. Linda is listening. She was one of the ladies, and she'll remember me.
All right, Linda, drop us an email. Let's get some more calls now. We've got a board full of calls and not enough time to get all these people on. So let's get to Andrew in Cheshire right now.
I'd like to ask Charles about something I saw back in the late 70s. I was only a child then, and it got me really interested in astronomy, and I went on to study astronomy. Now, I lived in a very open place, and I saw what I can only describe as a ball of light cross the horizon four times. I was a child, I really didn't think anything of it. But later on in life, after I'd studied astronomy, I seemed to realise that the only way this thing could have possibly done this was to have gone round the Earth within, a minute or 2 minutes or so.
So you think you've got proof of some kind of contact there, definitely, yeah?
Well, the strange thing is, I was about 8 or 9 years old at the time, so, like I said, I really didn't think anything of it. And about an hour later, I was with a group of people, kids just playing out at the time, and it was a clear night, and we also saw what looked like a star in the sky split into two and traveling two different directions.
Okay, Charles Hall in the United States. There's Andrew here in the UK tonight telling you those stories. You're a man who seems to have seen it all. Do they surprise you? Is that something you've heard before?
Well, I would ask, and the first one, for the object that appeared to have gone around the Earth, you know, in a minute or so, I would ask... is it possible that that he has a missing time experience in between there? Because the tall white aliens that I came across, they had this microwave device, which was about the size of a white pencil, and they could hypnotize a person so quickly.
Okay, well, Andrew's still on. Let's ask him that question. Are you missing any time, Andrew? I know you were a kid at the time, so it's hard to remember, but can you know, are you missing half an hour, whatever, that you can't account for?
I really couldn't say. I mean... I think I was with two other people at the time, And I can't remember them ever saying anything, but I mean, if it happened to us all at the same time, then maybe...
Because as I describe in my books, they could hypnotize me with that microwave thing. That one of my that like when I was walking from my theodolite to my weather shack, as I was in between step 12 and step 13, they could hypnotize me. Because when with those microwaves, it's like almost instantaneous.
So, Andrew, what you remember is perhaps not exactly what happened. Maybe your memory of it has been affected in some way. Want to get more calls on? Because got so many of these now. Brian in Birmingham.
Hello, Charles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Charles, did you ever find out where they came from and how they got here?
Their deep spacecraft could definitely travel faster than the speed of light, and I saw their deep spacecraft many times, as described in my books. I was never certain where they came from, although one night there were several of them standing around me, and I happened to mention the star Arcturus, which is 36 light years away, and they all got real nervous. I don't think they came from Arcturus, but I do think that Arcturus is one of the stopping places that one of the places they stopped at, or that they typically stopped at, and on their way here, I think all of them that were standing around me had been to Arcturus. My best guess was that their home star was perhaps a star that's 105 light years away, but I was never certain. They would never tell me. One time when I asked the teacher where they came from, she smiled and said, because they have a very dry sense of humor, she said, "Do you know the names that we use when we talk about the stars?" And I said, "No." And she said, "So if we told you, you still wouldn't know where we came from." And then they were all laughing at me because, you know, that for them, that was big entertainment. You know, they've outthought Charlie again.
Well, at least they've got a sense of humor. But it sounds like when you suggested Arcturus, you were getting a little close for comfort. Maybe, I'm not sure. Diane in London. Diane, what do you want to say to Charles Hall?
Oh, well, hello, Howard. Charles, could I ask you, what was it that put these people into the category of aliens, rather than some military come medical creation from DNA in a laboratory or something like that? I mean, why would they be on a military base? I mean, this happened at Bentwaters also in Britain with UFOs seen there. That was an American military base. And given that I'm regularly under military attack myself, waves through my brain, voices projected into my head and waves through my heart and all those things, I know the military can do all sorts of weird and horrible things. So could it not be military creations?
No, there wasn't a military creation. The base...
How do you know?
That's a good point, isn't it, Charles? How do you know?
I saw their deep spacecraft and they...
Well, yeah, but that could be a military creation. Aircraft can go as fast as... faster than sound and so on.
Well, they look so much like us. They live like 700 years. They live much longer than we do.
How do you know? Are you 750 years old?
No, I was born in Brooklyn, Wisconsin.
Diane,
I lived in London, Wisconsin.
Diane, good point. Listen, our time is very, very short, Charles Hall. I'd like to get you back on here another time because I think there is more to talk about and we've got so many calls coming in for you.
Yes, I am.
But when you think back on the experience, this is what I want you to sum up with, if you would.
Sure.
What does it leave you feeling? Does it leave you feeling humbled? Does it leave you feeling scared? Does it leave you feeling baffled? How would you sum it up in 2 or 3 seconds? What do you think?
It left me feeling very humble. My wife and I are quite religious, and when you looked at them, they loved their children and the way they worked. It was kind of like you were looking at the qualities that God had, because you could see so many similarities between them and us, even though they aren't human. You know, the way they love their kids, the way they work together and protect each other. And
Charles Hall in New Mexico, I'm grateful to you. We're going to have to break at this point. Paola Harris, UFO investigator, thank you to you too.
Alien contactee, he says. Charles Hall and Paola Harris, who now lives in the United States and continues her fine work researching ufology and space. Paola, if you're hearing this, I send you my regards from London town. Finally, on this archive edition of The Unexplained, by request, we have David von Kleist. It is 10 years this year since the calamity that was 9/11, and still the conspiracy theories go on. And will there ever be a total explanation as to how and why all of this happened? An explanation that satisfies everybody across the world? I think not. But one of the first off the blocks with a theory about it is David von Kleist, and he wrote a book called In Plain Sight, which was also a video presentation, and of course, I had him on as a guest.
The mainstream explanation as to what happened on September 11th certainly is not in any way, shape, or form aligned with the truth. And the production of this video presentation, I have to give credit where credit is due, is basically was made possible by the listeners of our radio broadcast, because when we went on the air on September 11th, it was 9 o'clock Eastern Time, 8 o'clock Central. And, of course, at that time, the North Tower had already been struck. The South Tower had yet to have been struck. And at the top of the hour, we went on the air, and the first thing out of my mouth was, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, drop it right now, run to your television and your VCR, put a blank tape in, and start taping any network that you can get clear reception on. And many of our listeners did exactly that. And as a result, we ended up with 65, 70 VCR tapes that came in the mail, covering virtually all of the different networks. We had the CNN coverage, Fox, ABC, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, and even local coverage in some cases.
What gave you at that point the presence of mind to make that call on air on that day when I can tell you as a journalist covering this story, we were all over the place. We were just so busy putting the facts and reports out there that being able to think forward to be, you know, to get people to record what is being put out by the network so we can analyze it later. You must have had a thought in your mind at that point that the true story of this is not going to be told unless we're very careful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They say that if you don't learn from your history, you're destined to repeat it.
So, Dave, what we're saying here is that quite often when things like this happen, huge cataclysmic events, attacks on our freedom, on our safety, on our security, sometimes the first version of what we hear is more accurate.
That's exactly right.
What we subsequently get, because what we get beyond that is somebody's spin.
That's exactly right, and that's precisely why when we went on the air, the first thing I said was, folks, start taping it right now, because this is history in the making, and the spin doctors, when it's being broadcast live, have no opportunity to massage or alter or manipulate this information. So this is why we had all of our listeners tape this, and I'm glad that they did.
Let's start off with a clip from your documentary. Here it is.
Mark Birnbach, a Fox employee, is on the phone with us. Mark witnessed this from what we understand. Mark, were you close enough to be able to see any markings on the airplane?
Hi, gentlemen. How you doing? Yeah, there was definitely a blue logo. It was like a circular logo on the front of the plane, towards the front. It definitely did not look like a commercial plane. I didn't see any windows on the sides. And definitely very low. And I'm completely panicked. You're freaking out. I can't believe what I just saw.
We are all shaken by this.
So that is one, Dave, of a whole patchwork of facts and information that came out from the live news reports broadcast at the time, that one from Fox News, but other news reports that were never referred to again. In other words, one of those planes was maybe not a passenger plane.
Well, that's true, and the reason we are doubting that it is a passenger plane is because of the video clips that we've seen, and I'm sure you've seen it as well. Many of the listeners have seen it as well. The CNN coverage, of course, went worldwide live, and if you'll picture in your mind's eye, the one clip I'm sure will stand up prominently is the clip where we see the South Tower right in front of you, and then the plane flies as if it came over your left shoulder and slams right into the building and explodes. Now, we've all seen that over and over again, but only for a few weeks. Shortly after that, if you recall, George Bush was on television making the statement, something to the effect of, we have to stop showing these terrible attacks on America no more because America needs time to heal. So they stopped showing that clip.
You do that so well, you know.
Oh, I know. Thanks.
but was the reason, wasn't it? We were told that we weren't being shown this stuff, and the people, you know, shaking their fists and hands out of broken windows in the Twin Towers. We weren't shown that stuff to protect people's sensibilities.
Right. They stopped showing those because we might see something that's inconsistent with the official story. Now, that particular clip is absolutely vital, because when you look at it in slow motion, and that's exactly what we did, we took the video on DVD that we got directly from CNN, and your listeners can get it too. I'm sure it's available online at Amazon.com or maybe some of your local bookstores has it. It's called America Remembers. It was published by CNN. And it's on DVD. So we went to the clip, and you can find that clip at 7 minutes and 35 seconds in the first chapter. And when you slow it down and examine it frame by frame, you can clearly see that there appears to be something attached to the belly of this plane.
I've heard that one, though, unpicked before, and people said, oh, well, it's a shadow, it's a reflection of one of the engines, it's not what it appears to be. But what are we saying it might be?
Now, we've talked to probably 3 or 4 dozen airline pilots who have all seen this photograph, and they've seen this video clip, and every single one of them agrees that there appears to be something attached to the belly of the plane that should not be there.
And if we're talking something that is not a passenger plane, what happened to the passengers?
I don't know. I don't know where the plane went. But this, wouldn't you say that this is cause for an investigation? Because if what we are seeing indicates that this was not a passenger plane, I mean, after all, with something this big attached, that would have that was reportedly a plane that had departed from Boston Logan International Airport, surely the baggage handlers or the food service personnel or the fuel handlers or the maintenance workers, passengers, crew members, pilots, control tower, somebody would have seen something this big, which indicates that if there is something attached to the belly of the plane, this could not be a commercial airliner at all.
9/11 researcher David von Kleist, whose work continues, it is the 10th anniversary of that terrible event, and we will hear more about it as this year continues, I'm sure. Thank you very much for being part of this special edition of The Unexplained, where we've trawled back through the archives of this show, and I've heard some material that I haven't heard for years. I hope if you're hearing it for the first time, you're enjoying it. Thank you to Adam Cornwell for devising this new website, www.theunexplained.tv. Please go to it, check it out, tell me what you think about it, and if you can, please leave a donation for the show, because that is vital to our ongoing work. I thank you for your support through 2010 as we go into 2011 now. I know you'll continue to be with me. Please tell your friends about this show. Please keep your feedback coming. Thank you very much. Thank you to Martin for the theme tune. I hope you're okay, Martin. As I say, thank you to Adam for his fantastic help, my webmaster. I could not do any of this without him at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. And above all else, thank you to you for supporting The Unexplained. My name is Howard Hughes. Happy New Year.